They were being hunted? Fear that someone else had taken over their lives? I kept thinking about Nana and how tough she was and how much I would have missed her if something had gone wrong that morning. The terrible guilt-ridden fantasy kept running through my head that I was going to get a call from Kayla Coles, and she would say, "I'm sorry. Nana passed away. We don't know what went wrong. I'm so sorry." The call didn't come, and I threw myself into the work. Nana would be home tomorrow. I needed to stop worrying about her and put my mind to better use. The Army records were interesting, but also about as depressing as an IRS audit. Obviously, there had been rogue activity in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. The Army, at least officially, seemed to turn a blind eye and not look too closely at what had happened. There weren't civilian review boards, of course, like the police departments had to investigate misconduct. The press had no way to judge what was going on either. They rarely interviewed victims' families in the small villages. Few of the American reporters spoke much Vietnamese. The good and bad of it was that the Army had sometimes fought fire with fire. Maybe it was the only way to effectively fight a guerrilla war. But I still didn't know what had happened over there to inspire the murder stateside during the past few years. I spent several grueling hours looking through more records of Colonel Thomas Starkey, Captain Brownlee Harris, and Sergeant Warren Griffin. I saw that their Army careers were exemplary, at least in written form. I went back as far as Vietnam, and the pattern continued. Starkey was a highly decorated officer. Harris and Griffin were good soldiers. There was nothing in the records about assassinations in Vietnam committed by the trio. Not a single word. I wanted to know when they had met and where they had served together. I kept leafing through records, hoping, but not finding the connect point. I knew they'd fought together in Vietnam and Cambodia. I went through every page a second time, but there was nothing in any of the records to indicate they'd worked together in Southeast Asia. Not a goddamn word. I sat back and stared out onto Fifth Street, letting my eyes glaze over. There was only one conclusion I could come up with, and I didn't like it. The Army records had been doctored. But why? And by whom? Chapter 104. It wasn't over yet. I could feel it in the pit of my stomach, and I hated the queasy feeling, the uncertainty, the lack of closure. Or maybe I just couldn't let go. All those unsolved murders. Who was the real killer? Who was behind the strange murders? A week after the shooting in Georgia, I sat in Ronald Burns' office on the fifth floor of FBI headquarters in Washington. Burns' assistant, a crew-cut male in his mid-20s, had just brought us coffee in beautiful china cups. There were also fresh mini pastries on a silver tray. "Pulling out all the stops?" I asked the director. "Hot coffee and Danish." "You got it," he said. "Shameless manipulation. Go with it." I'd known him for years, but it was only during the past few months that I'd worked closely with Burns. What I'd seen so far I liked, but I'd been fooled before. "How's Kyle Craig doing?" I asked him. "We're trying to make it as uncomfortable as possible for him out in Colorado," Burns said. He allowed himself a smile. Craig was a former senior agent I'd helped put away. I still didn't know exactly how many murders he had committed, but it was at least 11, probably many more. Burns and I had believed Kyle was our friend. It was the worst betrayal in my lifetime, but not the only one. "We have to keep him in solitary most of the day. For his own protection, of course. He hates being by himself, drives him crazier. No one to show off for." "No psychiatrists in there trying to figure Kyle out?" Burns shook his head. No, not a good idea. That would be too dangerous for them. Besides, Kyle would like the attention. He craves it. He's a junkie for it."
"Exactly."
We smiled at the image of Kyle locked away in seclusion, hopefully for the rest of his life. Unfortunately, I knew he had made contact with others in the MAC security unit, particularly Tran Van Lo. "You don't think Kyle had anything to do with these killings?" Burns finally asked. "I checked that out as much as I could. There's no evidence he knew Lowe before he was assigned to Florence. I know he visited out there, Alex, when he was still with the Bureau. He was definitely on the Max security unit as well as death row. He could have met Lowe. It's possible. I'm afraid you never know with Kyle. I almost didn't want to think about the unlikely possibility that Kyle might be behind the diabolical murder scheme somehow. But it was possible. Still, it seemed so unlikely that I didn't give it much credence. You had any time to think about my offer? Burns asked. I still don't have an answer for you. I'm sorry. This is a big decision for me and my family. If it's any consolation, once I land, I don't jump around. Okay, that's fine with me. You understand I can't leave the offer on the table indefinitely. I nodded. I appreciate the way you're handling this. You always this patient? Whenever I can be, Burns said, and left it at that. He picked up a couple of manila folders from the coffee table between our chairs. He slid them my way. I have something for you, Alex. Take a look. Chapter 105. More of the Bureau's resources that you want me to see, I said, and smiled at Burns. You'll like this. It's real good stuff. I hope it's helpful. I want to see you get some closure on this Army case. We're interested in this one, too. I reached into one of the folders and pulled out what looked like a faded patch from a jacket. I held it up to examine the cloth more closely. The patch was green khaki with what looked like a crossbow sewed into the fabric. There was also a straw doll on the patch. An eerie, awful straw doll. The same kind I'd first seen in Ellis Cooper's house. The patch came from the jacket of a 16-year-old gang member in New York City. The gang he belonged to is named Ghost Shadows. They use different coffee shops on Canal Street in New York as headquarters. It's called Roving Turf, Burns said. A task force we ran with the NYPD brought the gangbanger in. He decided to trade some information he thought might be valuable to the NYPD. It wasn't, but it could be valuable to you. How so? I asked. He says he sent you several emails during the past month, Alex. He used computers at a technical high school in New York. He's foot soldier? I asked, and shook my head in amazement. No, but he may be a messenger for foot soldier. He's Vietnamese. The symbol of the crossbow is from a popular folktale. In the story, the crossbow could kill 10,000 men every time it was fired. The Ghost Shadows think of themselves as very powerful. They're big into symbols, myth, magic. As I said, this kid and his fellow gangbangers spend most of their time in the coffee shops, playing Tin Lin, drinking Café Soda. The gang moved to New York from Orange County in California. Over 150,000 Viet refugees have settled in Orange County since the 70s. The gang in New York favored Vietnamese-style criminal activities. Smuggling illegal aliens, called snakeheads, credit card fraud, software and computer parts heists. That help you? I nodded. Of course it does. Burns handed me another folder. This might help, too. It's information about the former leader of the Viet gang. Tran Van Lo. Burns nodded. I did a tour in 69 and 70. I was in the Marines. We had our own recon people. They'd get dropped into hostile territory, just like Starkey and company. Vietnam was a guerrilla war, Alex. Some of our people acted like guerrillas. Their job was to wreak havoc behind enemy lines. They were tough, brave, but more than a few of them got incredibly desensitized. Sometimes they practiced situational ethics. Wreak havoc, I said. You're talking about terrorism, aren't you? Yeah, Burns nodded. That's what I just said. Chapter 106. The FBI flew me out to Colorado this time. Ron Burns had made this his case now, too. He wanted the person or persons behind the long string of murders. The isolation unit at Florence seemed as oppressive as it had been on my first visit there. As I entered the security housing unit, guards in khaki uniforms watched me through bulletproof glass observation windows. The doors were either bright orange or mint green. Odd. There were cameras every 10 feet along the bland, sand-colored walls. The cell where Tran Van Lo and I met had a table and 2 chairs, which were bolted to the floor. 3 guards in body armor and thick gloves brought him to me this time around. I wondered if there had been trouble recently. Violence? Lo's hands and ankles were cuffed and manacled for our meeting. The gray hairs hanging from his chin seemed even longer than at our last visit. I took the jacket patch Burns had given me out of the pocket of my coat. What does this mean? No more bullshit.
Ghost shadows. You know that already. The crossbar is just folklore. Just a design.
And the straw doll? He was silent for a moment. I noticed that Lo's hands were curled into fists.
I believe I told you that I was a scout for the American Army. Sometimes we left calling cards in villages. One, I remember, was a skull and crossbones with the words, "When you care enough to send the very best." The Americans thought that was very funny.
What does the straw doll mean? Is it your calling card? Was it left at all the murder scenes? Or afterward at the soldiers' homes? He shrugged.
Perhaps. You tell me, detective. I wasn't at the murder scenes.
What would this particular calling card mean? The straw doll?
Many things, detective. Life is not so simple. Life is not merely sound bites and easy solutions. In my country, popular religion is flexible. Buddhism from both China and India, Taoism, Confucianism. Ancestor worship is the oldest and most indigenous belief throughout Vietnam.
I tapped my finger on the jacket patch.
Straw dolls are sometimes burned or floated away on a river as part of rituals honoring the dead. Evil spirits are the ghosts of those who were murdered or who died without proper burial. The straw doll is a threatening message reminding the offending person it is they who should rightfully be in the doll's place.
I nodded. Tell me what I need to know. I don't want to have to come back here.
Nor should you. I don't have any need for confession. That's more a Western concept.
You don't feel any guilt about what's happened? Innocent people have died.
And will continue to. What is it that you really want to know? Do you believe I owe you something because of your crackerjack detective work?
You admit that you used me. Lo shrugged.
I don't admit anything. Why should I? I was a guerrilla fighter. I survived in the jungles of An Lao for nearly 6 years. Then I survived in the jungles of California and New York. I use whatever is provided to me. I try to make the most of this situation. You do the same, I'm sure.
Like at this prison?
Oh, especially in prison. Otherwise, even a reasonably bright man could go mad. You've heard the phrase cruel and unusual? A cell that is 7 by 12 feet, 23 hours a day in it, communication only through a cell slot in the door.
I leaned across the table, my face close to Lo's. Blood was pounding inside my head. Tran Van Lo was foot soldier. He had to be, and he had the answers that I wanted. Was he also responsible for all these murders? So why did you kill Sergeant Ellis Cooper? The others? Why did they have to die? Is it all just revenge? Tell me what the hell happened in the An Lao Valley. Tell me and I'll go away. He shook his head.
I've told you enough. Go home, detective. You don't need to hear any more. Yes, I am foot soldier. The other answers you seek are too much for the people in your country to hear. Let this murder case go. Just this once, detective. Let it go.
Chapter 107. I made no move to get up and leave. Tran Van Lo stared at me impassively. Then he smiled. Had he expected this? Stubbornness? Obtuseness? Was that why he'd involved me in the first place? Had he talked to Kyle Craig about me? How much did he know? Everything? Or just more pieces of the puzzle?
Your continuing journey is interesting to me. I don't understand men like you. You want to know why terrible things happen. You want to make things right, if only occasionally. You've dealt with vicious killers before. Gary Sinise, Jeffrey Schaefer, Kyle Craig, of course. Your country has produced so many killers, Bundy, Dahmer, all the others. I don't know why this happens in such a civilized country, a place with so many blessings.
I shook my head. I really didn't know either. But Lowe wanted to hear what I had to say on the subject. Had he asked Kyle the same questions?
I've always felt it has something to do with high expectations. Many Americans expect to be happy, expect to be loved. When we aren't, some of us go into a rage, especially if it happens to us as children. If instead of love we experience hatred and abuse. What I don't understand is why so many Americans abuse their children.
Lowe stared at me, and I could sense his eyes probing into mine. Was he a strange new kind of killer? A Lord Executioner? He seemed to have a conscience. He was philosophical. A philosopher warrior? How much did he know? Did the case end here? Why did someone orchestrate the murder of Ellis Cooper? I finally asked. Simple question. Will you answer it for me? He frowned.
All right. I will do that much. Cooper lied to you and your friend Sampson. He had no choice but to lie. Sergeant Cooper was in the Anlao Valley, although his records don't say so. I saw him execute a girl of 12. Slender, beautiful, innocent. He killed the girl after he had raped her. I have no reason to lie about that. Sergeant Cooper was a murderer and rapist. They all committed atrocities. They were all murderers. Cooper, Tate, Houston, Etra, Harris, Griffin, and Starkey too. The blind mice. They were among the worst, the most bloodthirsty. That's why I chose them to hunt down the others. Yes, I was the one, detective. But I'm already condemned to death here. There's nothing more you can do to me. Colonel Starkey was never told why the murders were taking place in the U.S. He didn't know my identity. He was an assassin, he never asked. He just wanted his money. I believe in rituals and symbolism, and I believe in revenge. The guilty have been punished, and their punishment fits the crimes. Our unburied dead have been revenged, and their souls can finally rest. Your soldiers left their calling cards, and so did I. I had plenty of time to think about it in here, plenty of time to make my plans. I hungered for revenge, and I didn't want it to be simple or easy. As you Americans say, I wanted payback. I got it, detective. Now I am at peace.
Nothing was as it seemed. Ellis Cooper had lied from the start. He'd proclaimed his innocence to Sampson and me, but I believed Tran Van Lowe. The way he told the story was entirely convincing. He had witnessed atrocities in his country and maybe even committed them himself. What was the phrase Burns had used? Wreak havoc.
There was a saying the army had in the Anlao Valley. Do you want to hear it?
Yes. I need to understand as much as I can. It's what drives me.
The phrase was, if it moves, it's VC.
Not all our soldiers did that.
Not many, actually, but some. They came into villages in the out country. They would kill everyone they found. If it moves, they wanted to frighten the Viet Cong, and they did. They left calling cards, like the Straw Dolls detective, in village after village. They destroyed an entire country, a culture.
Lowe paused for a moment, possibly to let me think about what I had heard so far.
They liked to paint the faces and bodies of the dead. The favorite colors were red, white, and blue. They thought this was so humorous, too. They never buried the bodies, just left them for the loved ones to find. I found my family with their faces painted blue. Their ghost shadows have been haunting me since that day.
I had to stop him for a moment. Why didn't you tell anyone? Why didn't you go to the army when this was happening? He looked straight into my eyes.
I did, Detective. I went to Owen Handler, my first CO. I told him what was happening in the An Lao. He already knew. His CO knew. They all knew. Several teams had gotten out of control, so he had the assassins sent in to clean up the mess.
And what about all the innocent victims here? What about the women Starkey and his crew murdered in order to set up Cooper and the others?
Ah, your army had a term for that. Collateral damage.
One more question, I said to Lo, while everything he'd told me was boiling inside my head.
Ask. Then I want you to leave me alone. I don't want you to come back.
You didn't kill Colonel Handler, did you?
No. Why should I put him out of his misery? I wanted Colonel Handler to live with his cowardice and shame. Now go, we are finished.
Who killed Handler?
Who knows? Perhaps there is a fourth blind mouse.
I got up to leave, and the guards came into the cell. I could see that they were afraid of Lo, and I wondered what he had done in his time here. He was a scary and complicated man, a ghost shadow. He had plotted several murders of revenge.
There's something else,
he finally said. Then he smiled. The smile was horrible, a grimace, no joy or mirth in it.
Kyle Craig says hello. The two of us talk. We even talk about you sometimes. Kyle says that you should stop us while you can. He says that you should put us both down.
Lo laughed as he was led from the cell.
You should stop us, Detective.
Be careful of Kyle, I said, offering some advice. He isn't anybody's friend.
Nor am I,
said Tran Van Lo. Chapter 108. As soon as Lo was taken away, Kyle Craig was brought into the interview room on death row in the isolation unit. I was waiting for him, with bells on.
I expected you'd stop by to visit, Alex,
he said as he was escorted inside by three armed guards.
You don't disappoint, never, ever.
Always one step ahead, isn't that right, Kyle? I asked. He laughed, but without a trace of mirth, as he looked around at the cell, the guards.
Apparently not. Not anymore.
Kyle sat across from me. He was so incredibly gaunt and seemed to have lost even more weight since I'd seen him last. I sensed that his mind was going a mile a minute inside that bony skull. You were caught because you wanted to be caught, I said. That's obvious.
Oh, Christ, spare me the psychobabble. If you've come as Dr. Cross, the psychologist, you can turn around and leave right now. You'll bore me to tears.
I was talking as a homicide detective, I said.
Well, that's a little better, I suppose. I can stomach you as a sanctimonious cop. You're not much of a shrink, but then again, it's not much of a profession. Never did anything for me.
I have my own philosophy. Kill them all, let God sort them out.
Analyze that.
I didn't say anything. Kyle had always liked to hear himself talk. If he asked questions, he often wanted to ridicule whatever you said in response. He lived to bait and taunt. I doubted that anything had changed with him. Finally, he smiled.
Oh, Alex, you are the clever one, aren't you? Sometimes I have the terrifying thought that you're the one who's always a step ahead.
I didn't take my eyes away from his. I don't think so, Kyle.
But you're persistent as an attack dog from hell, relentless, isn't that right?
I don't think about it much. If you say so, I probably am. His eyes narrowed.
Now you're being condescending. I don't like that.
Who cares what you like anymore?
Point taken, I must remember that.
I asked before if you can help me with Tran Van Lo, the murders he's involved in. Have you changed your mind? I suspect there's still one murderer out there. Kyle shook his head. His eyes narrowed.
I'm not foot soldier. I'm not the one trying to help you. Some mysteries just never get solved. Don't you know that yet?
I shook my head. You're right, I said. I am relentless. I'm going to try to solve this one, too. Then Kyle slowly clapped his hands, making a hollow popping sound.
That's our boy. You're just perfect, Alex. What a fool you are. Go find your murderer.
Chapter 109. Samson was recuperating on the Jersey shore with Billy Houston, his own private nurse. I called him just about every day, but I didn't tell John what I'd heard about Sergeant Ellis Cooper and the others. I also called Jamila every day, sometimes a couple of times a day, or she'd call or email me. The distance separating us was becoming more and more of an issue. Neither of us had a good solution yet. Could I ever move the family to California? Could Jamila move to Washington? We needed to talk about it face to face, and pretty soon. After I returned from Colorado, I spent a couple of days working in Washington. I knew that I had one more important trip to make, but I needed some more preparation first. Measure twice, cut once. Nana had always preached that to me. I spent countless hours on Lexis, but also the military database, ACIRS, and the law enforcement system, RISS. I made a visit to the Pentagon and talked to a Colonel Pizer about violence against civilians committed by American soldiers in Southeast Asia. When I brought up the An Lao Valley, Pizer abruptly cut off the interview, and then he refused to see me again. In a strange way, that was a very good sign. I was close to something, wasn't I? I talked to a few friends who had served in Vietnam. The phrase, "if it moves, it's VC," was familiar to most of them. Those who knew about it justified it, since violent outrages were constantly being committed by the North Vietnamese. One Army vet told this story. He'd overheard other soldiers talk about a Vietnamese man in his mid-80s who'd been shot down. "Got to hand it to him," a gunnery sergeant had joked. "Man his age and he volunteers for the Viet Cong." And one name kept coming up whenever I talked about the An Lao Valley. In the records, everywhere I looked. One name that was a link to so much that had happened, there and here. The fourth of the blind mice? I had to find that out now. Early on Thursday morning, I left for West Point. It would be about a 5-hour drive. I was in no particular hurry. The person I wanted to see there wasn't going anywhere. He didn't think he had any reason to run and hide. I loaded up the CD player with the blues mostly, but also the new Bob Dylan, which I wanted to hear at least once. I brought along a thermos of coffee as well as sandwiches for the road. I told Nana that I would try to be home that night, to which she curtly replied, "Try harder. Try more often." The drive gave me time to think. I needed to be sure that I was doing the right thing by going to West Point again. I asked myself a lot of tough but necessary questions. When I was satisfied with the answers, I gave some more thought to taking a job with the FBI. Director Ron Burns had done a good job showing me the kind of resources I'd have at the Bureau. The message was clear, and it was also clever. I would be better at what I did working for the FBI. Hell, I didn't know what I wanted to do, though. I knew that I could make it in private practice as a psychologist now, if that was what I really wanted. Maybe I could do a better job with the kids if I had a regular job instead of the job. Use those marbles wisely. Savor those precious Saturdays. Make a go of it with Jamila, who was constantly in my thoughts, and should be. Eventually, I found myself on Route 9W, following road signs for Highland Falls and West Point. As I got close to the point, I checked my Glock and put a clip in. I wasn't sure I'd need a gun. Then again, I hadn't thought I'd need one the night Owen Handler was murdered near here. I entered West Point through the Thayer Gate at the north end of Highland Falls. Cadets were all over the plane parade drilling, still looking beyond reproach. Smoke curled lazily from a couple of chimneys on top of Washington Hall. I liked West Point a lot. I also admired most of the men and women I'd met in the Army, But not all of them. And everybody knows what a few bad apples can do. I pulled up in front of a red brick building. I had come here for answers. One name was left on my shopping list. A big name. A man beyond reproach. General Mark Hutchinson, the commandant of West Point. He had avoided me the night Owen Handler had been murdered, but that wasn't going to happen again. Chapter 110. I climbed steep stone steps and let myself into the well-kept building that housed the offices of the commandant of West Point. A soldier with a high and tight haircut was sitting behind a dark wooden desk that held a highly polished brass lamp and orderly stacks of papers and portfolios. He looked up, cocking his head like a curious and alert grade school student.
"Yes, sir. Can I help you, sir?"
"My name is Detective Alex Cross. I believe General Hutchinson will see me. Please tell him that I'm here." The soldier's head remained tilted at the curious angle.
"Yes, sir, Detective. Could you tell me something about your business with the General, sir?"
"I'm afraid that I can't. I believe the General will see me, though. He already knows who I am." I went and sat on a stuffed chair across the room. "I'll be right here waiting for the General." The soldier at the desk was clearly frustrated. He wasn't used to civil disobedience, especially not in General Hutchinson's office. He thought about it, then finally picked up the plain black phone on his desk and called someone further up the chain of command. I figured that was a good thing, a necessary next step. A few minutes passed before a heavy wooden door behind his heavy wooden desk opened. An officer in uniform appeared and walked straight over to me.
"I'm Colonel Walker, the General's adjutant. You can leave now, Detective Cross. General Hutchinson won't be seeing you today. You have no jurisdiction here."
I nodded. "But I do have some important information General Hutchinson should listen to. It's about events that took place during his command in the An Lao Valley. This was in 67 through 71, but in particular, 69.
"I assure you, the General has no interest in meeting with you or hearing any old war stories you have to tell."
"I have a meeting set up with the Washington Post about this particular information," I said. I thought the General should hear the allegations first. Colonel Walker nodded his head once, but didn't seem impressed or worried.
"If you have someone in Washington who wants to listen to your story, you should go there with it. Now please leave the building or I'll have you escorted out."
"No need to waste the manpower," I said, and got up from the cushy armchair. "I'm good at escorting myself." I went outside on my own steam and walked to my car. I got in and slowly drove up the pretty main drag that cuts through West Point. I was thinking hard about what to do next. I eventually parked on a side street lined with tall maples and oaks that had a majestic view of the Hudson. I waited there. The General will see me. Chapter 111. It was past dark when a black Ford Bronco turned into the driveway of a large colonial-style house that was flanked by elm trees and ringed by stockade fencing. General Mark Hutchinson stepped out of his vehicle. The interior lights illuminated his face for a few seconds. He didn't look one bit worried. Why should he? He had been to war several times, and he'd always survived. I waited about 10 minutes for him to put the house lights on, then get settled in. I knew that Hutchinson was divorced and lived alone. Actually, I knew a lot about the General by now. I walked up the front steps, much as I'd gone up the steps to the General's office earlier that afternoon. The same deliberate pace. Relentless, unstoppable, stubborn as hell. I was going to talk to Hutchinson today, one way or the other. I had business to finish. This was my last case, after all. I banged the front door's iron knocker a couple of times, a tarnished winged goddess that I found to be more imposing than inviting. Hutchinson finally came to the door in a blue-checked sports shirt and pressed khaki slacks. It looked like a corporate executive caught at home by a pesky door-to-door salesman, and none too happy about the interruption at this time of night.
"I'm going to have you arrested for trespassing,"
he said when he saw me. As I'd told the soldier in his reception area, the General knew who I was. That being the case, I pushed my way through the front door. Hutchinson was a broad-shouldered man, but in his 60s. He didn't try to stop me, didn't touch me at all.
Haven't you caused enough trouble? I believe you have.
Not really. I'm just getting started. I walked into a spacious living room and sat down. The room had deep couches, brass floor lamps, curtains in warm blues and reds. His ex-wife's taste, I assumed. This won't take too long, General. Let me tell you what I know about Ann Lau. Hutchinson tried to cut me off.
I'll tell you what you don't know, mister. You don't know how the Army works, and you don't seem to know much about life in power circles either. You're out of your depth here. Leave now. Take your goddamn stories to the Washington Post.
Starkey, Griffin, and Brownlee Harris were military assassins assigned to you in Vietnam, I began. The general frowned and shook his head, but finally seemed resigned to hearing me out. He sat down.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I've never heard of any of those men.
You sent 10-person teams into the An Lao Valley specifically to intimidate the Vietnamese. It was a guerrilla war, and your teams were instructed to act like guerrillas. They committed murders, mutilations. They slaughtered non-combatants. They had a calling card. They painted their victims red, white, or blue. It got out of control, didn't it, General? Hutchinson actually smiled.
Where did you dig up this ridiculous shit? You have some fucking imagination. Now get the hell out of here.
I continued. You destroyed the records that these men were even in the An Lao Valley. The same was true of the three assassins, Starkey, Griffin, and Harris, the ones you sent to clean up the mess. That's how I first found out about the deception. They told me they were there, but their army records said otherwise. The general looked uninterested in what I had to say. It was all an act, of course. I wanted to get up and punch him until he told me the truth. The records weren't destroyed, General, I went on. Finally, I had his attention.
What the hell are you talking about?
Just what I said. The records weren't destroyed. An ARVN scout named Tran Van Lo brought the atrocities to the attention of his CO, none other than Colonel Owen Handler. No one would listen, of course, so Lo stole copies of records and took them to the North Vietnamese. Those records were held in Hanoi until 1997. Then the CIA happened to obtain copies. I got my copies from the FBI, as well as from the Vietnamese embassy. So maybe I do know a little about life in Washington's power circles. I even know that you're being considered for the Joint Chiefs, but not if any of this started to come out.
You're crazy. You're out of your mind.
Am I? Two teams of 10 men each committed 100 or more murders of civilians in villages during 68 and 69. You were the commanding officer. You gave the orders. When the teams got out of control, you sent in Starkey and his men to tidy up. Unfortunately, they killed a few civilians themselves. More recently, you gave the order to have Colonel Handler killed. Handler knew about your role in the An Lao Valley. Your career would have been ruined, and you might have even gone to jail. You went up country with Starkey, Harris, and Warren Griffin yourself. You were there, Hutchinson, in the An Lao Valley. You're responsible for everything that went wrong. You were there. You made it 4 blind mice. Hutchinson suddenly turned around in his chair.
Walker, Taravella, you can come in now. We've heard more than enough from this bastard.
2 men entered through a side door. They both had guns drawn, pointed at me.
Now you don't get to leave, Dr. Cross,
said Colonel Walker.
You don't get to go home.
Chapter 112. My hands were cuffed tightly behind my back. Then I was pushed outside and shoved down into the trunk of a dark sedan by the 2 armed men. I lay curled up like a blanket or rug in there. For a man my size, it was a tight squeeze. I could feel the car back out of Hutchinson's driveway, bump over the gutter, then turn onto the street. The sedan rode inside West Point at a reasonable speed, no more than 20 miles per hour. I was sure we were leaving the grounds when the car finally sped up. I didn't know who was up front, whether General Hutchinson had come along with his men. It seemed likely that I was going to be killed soon. I couldn't imagine how I would get out of this one. I thought about the kids and Nana and Jamila. and I wondered why I'd risked my life again. Was it a sign of good character, or a serious character flaw? And did it really matter anymore? Eventually, the car turned off the smooth highway surface onto a seriously bumpy road that was probably unpaved. I estimated that we were about 40 minutes from West Point. So how much longer did I have to live? The car rolled to a stop, and I heard the doors open and slam shut. Then the trunk was sprung. The first face I saw was Hutchinson's. There was no emotion in his eyes. Nothing human looked back at me. The two others were behind him. They had handguns pointed my way. Their stares were blank as well. "What are you going to do?" I asked a question that I already knew the answer to.
"What we should have done the night you were with Owen Handler, kill you,"
said Colonel Walker.
"With extreme prejudice,"
added the general. Chapter 113. I was lifted out of the car trunk and unceremoniously dropped on the ground. I landed hard on my hip. Pain lanced my body. Just the beginning, I knew. These bastards were out to hurt me before they killed me. I was handcuffed, and there was nothing I could do to stop them. Colonel Walker reached toward me and ripped open my shirt. The other man was pulling off my shoes, then my pants. Suddenly I was naked and shivering in the woods somewhere in upstate New York. The air was cold, probably in the low 40s.
"Do you know what my real crime is? Do you know what I did that was so wrong in Vietnam?"
Hutchinson asked.
"I gave the fucking order to fight back. They killed and maimed our men. They practiced terrorism and sadism. They tried to intimidate us in every way they could. I wouldn't be intimidated. I fought back, Cross, just like I'm fighting back now."
"You also murdered non-combatants, disgraced your command." I spit the words at him. The general leaned in close.
"You weren't there, so don't tell me what I did or didn't do. We won in the An Lao Valley. Back then, we used to say there were only two kinds in the world, the motherfuckers and the motherfucked. I'm a motherfucker, Cross. Guess what that makes you?"
Colonel Walker and the other man had paint and brushes. They began to swab cold paint onto my body.
"Thought you would appreciate this touch," Walker said. "I was in the An Lao Valley, too. You going to tell the Washington Post on me?"
There was nothing I could do to stop this. No one could help me, either. I was naked in the world and all alone. And now I was being painted. Their calling card before they killed me. I shivered in the cold. I could see in their eyes that killing me meant nothing to them. They'd murdered before. Owen Handler, for one. So how much longer did I have? A few minutes? Maybe a couple of hours of torture? No more than that. A gunshot rang out in the blackness. It seemed to come from beyond the headlights of the blue sedan we'd driven therein. What the hell? A dark hole opened in Colonel Walker's face, just below his left eye. Blood spurted. He flopped over backward, landing with a heavy thud on the forest floor. The back of his head was gone. Just blown away. The second soldier tried to duck, and a bullet drilled his lower spine. He screamed, then fell and rolled right over me. I saw men come swarming out of the woods. At least half a dozen. I counted 9, 10 of them. I couldn't see who they were in the darkness. Who in hell was rescuing me? Then as they came closer, moonlight illuminated some of their features. My God! I didn't know them, but I knew where they had come from and who had sent them. Either to follow me or to kill Hutchinson. The ghost shadows were here. Tran Van Lo's people had been tracking me. Or Hutchinson. They were speaking in Vietnamese. I didn't understand a word they were saying. Two of them grabbed the general and threw him to the ground. They began to kick him in the head, the chest, and stomach, in the genitals. He cried out in pain, but the beating continued, almost as if they couldn't hear him. They left me alone. But I had no illusions. I was a witness to this. I lay with my face pressed against the ground. I watched the attack from the lowest vantage point. The beating of General Hutchinson seemed unreal, almost inhuman. They were now kicking Colonel Walker and the other soldier as well. Beating the dead. One of them took out a serrated knife and cut Hutchinson. His scream pierced the night. It was obvious that they wanted to hurt the general, but not kill him. They meant to torture and terrorize, to wreak havoc. One of Lowe's men pulled out a straw doll. He threw the doll at Hutchinson. He then stabbed the general in the lower stomach. Hutchinson screamed again. The stomach wound wouldn't be fatal. The torture was going to continue, and sooner or later they would paint all of our bodies.
I believe in rituals and symbolism, and I believe in revenge.
Tran Van Lo had told me that in prison. One of his men finally came for me. I curled into a protective ball. No one could save me now. I knew the Ghost Shadow's plan. Wreak havoc. Get revenge for ancestors who had been murdered but never buried.
You want to watch or go?
The man asked. His voice was surprisingly calm.
You're free to go, Detective.
I looked into his eyes. Go, I said. The Ghost Shadow helped me to my feet, took off my cuffs. Then he led me away. He threw me rags to clean up with. A second man brought my clothes and shoes. They were both respectful. Then I was brought to the gates of West Point, near 9W, where I was released unharmed. I had no doubt that those were Tran Van Lo's explicit orders. I ran to get help for General Hutchinson and his men, but I knew I was already too late. Foot Soldier had killed them.
Chapter 114.
Ron Burns finally reached me at home the following afternoon. I was up in my office, standing at the bay window, looking down on Fifth Street and the rest of the neighborhood. Janie was down on the front lawn teaching little Alex how to play tag. She was even letting her brother win, but that wouldn't last long. Burns was saying, "Alex, I just got off the phone with a special agent named Mel Goods. He called me from a small town in upstate New York called Ellenville. You ever hear of Ellenville?" "Actually, no. But I think I've been there recently," I said. "Have I?" "Yeah, you have," Burns said. "That's where they took you from West Point." "What was Agent Goods doing in Ellenville?" I asked. "We were called in by the local police from up that way. They were puzzled, and frankly, shocked, by a mess some local deer hunters found in the mountains this morning." "I'll bet they were. Three murder victims. A grotesque death scene. Ritualistic. Three unidentified males. It really shook up the locals. They blocked off half the mountain. The victims had severe cuts and electrical burns all over their bodies." The initial police report said they had been sodomized / cauterized. The faces had been painted. Red, white, and blue. I was only half listening now. Janie was teaching little Alex how to lose a tag. He started to cry, and she picked him up and hugged him. She looked up at my window and waved. She had it all under control. That was Janie. Meanwhile, I was thinking about torture, terrorism, things that happen in the name of war. Jihad, whatever. When would it stop? Probably never, or not until somebody blew up our beloved planet. How totally insane of us. "I was wondering if you could shed any more light on the three murders," Burns asked. "Can you, Alex?" I waved back to the kids, then walked over to my desk and sat down. There was a picture of Maria with Janie and Damon when they were little. I wondered what she would have thought of all this. The kids, me, Jamila. Murder victims painted the colors of the American flag. Two of the victims are probably General Mark Hutchinson and a colonel named Walker. The third man is a PFC at West Point. I didn't catch his name. Hutchinson was responsible for some atrocities over 30 years ago in Vietnam. It finally caught up with him. I told Burns almost everything I knew about the night before. As always, he was a good listener. I appreciated that more and more, and I was beginning to think that I trusted him. "You know who killed the three West Pointers?" he finally asked. I thought about that for a moment, then said that I didn't. Technically, that was true. Burns asked a few more questions, but he accepted what I'd told him. I'd liked that, too. It meant that he accepted my judgment. I made another judgment then and there about the FBI director. I'll come work for you, I told him. I'll join the FBI. Like you said, it'll be fun. Who says the offer is still open? Byrne said, and laughed. I like that, too.
Epilogue. The Garter. Chapter 115.
The last thing I expected this year was a big, joyful wedding. I stood holding Jamila's hand and looking out over the beautiful grounds in Falls Church, Virginia. The setting was a sprawling meadow behind a small restaurant inn. Yellow and white lights had been strung in the elm trees and along the patio rails. Everywhere I looked, there were roses and marigolds and simple but quite beautiful English daisies. The bride was absolutely gorgeous in a simple white satin gown with no fussy train or veils. The dress was in the empire style and draped elegantly on Billy's small frame. She wore a necklace and earrings made from brightly colored cowrie shells to celebrate her African-American heritage. Her hair was swept back in a chignon with sprigs of baby's breath tucked in just so. Billy couldn't have looked more joyous or happier. Her smile was radiant all through the day. Samson never stopped smiling either. He was dressed up in a dove gray suit, and I swear he looked like a prince. A friend of ours, Reverend Jeffrey Campbell, had agreed to perform the ceremony in front of nearly 100 of us who loved John and Billy with all our hearts. Reverend Campbell asked if we would do everything in our power to support this new family in the community. "We will," everyone answered with great enthusiasm and warmth. The reception followed, and I got to say a few words and a champagne toast. I have known this large man since we were both small boys. At least I was a boy. He has always been a part of our family and always will be. John is loyal to his friends. His word is the truth. He's honorable, kind, generous, sweet, believe it or not, which is why he is my best friend in all the world. I have not known Billy quite as long, but I already like her a lot better than John. To a long, happy life together. I love you, John, and Billy. Now let's hear some music. Let's dance until tomorrow. John and his wife danced to Let's Stay Together. Then Jamila and I joined in with several other couples. Nice wedding, she said. I like John and Billy as a couple. They're great. Folks started to stack their plates with food. Coconut chicken and cornbread stuffing, dumplings, dirty rice, greens. Everybody was snapping pictures with the single-use cameras left on each table. Billy's best friend from nursing school sang, "Our Love is Here to Stay," and it was good. John and I got together on sexual healing, and it was pretty bad, which was why it was so good. The children were underfoot at all times, and Samson still hadn't stopped smiling. Late in the afternoon, Damon and Janny each grabbed one of my arms and escorted me out into the yard. "I'll be right back," I said to Jamila. "I hope." Billy was seated on a wooden chair with her back to half a dozen woeful-looking, even terrorized, single males. "You don't have to actually catch the garter," she said, turning and winking. "The first one who touches it is the lucky winner." I stood on one side of the ragtag boys' club, and I was winking and making ridiculous faces at Damon and Janny, and of course, Jamila. Suddenly, they all pointed toward the sky. I looked up, and the purple garter was spinning and spiraling down toward me. I couldn't have gotten out of the way if I'd wanted to. So I caught the garter and twirled it around my outstretched finger. "Doesn't scare me," I said. I looked to my left, and there was Jamila with Nana. Jam was laughing and clapping her hands, and her smile said, "Doesn't scare me either." I looked away, and by God, there was Dr. Kayla Coles. And she wasn't clapping, just smiling coyly. Then she winked at me. Now, what did that mean? I shook my head, still laughing, but then I saw one more face. Director Ron Burns of the FBI. My new boss was motioning for me to come over to see him. He had some kind of thick folder under his arm, which I had absolutely no plans of reading that Saturday. But I did.
written by James Patterson and read by Peter J. Fernandez and Michael Emerson. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Production supervised by Dennis Kao. Four Blind Mice is also available in hardcover from Little Brown and Company. To listen to samples, read more about the authors, learn about digital audio, and buy digital audio books, please visit Time Warner Audiobooks websites at www.twbookmark.com and www.mytimewarneraudio.com. This book is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Coming from James Patterson and Time Warner Audiobooks, Maximum Ride, The Angel Experiment. Six genetically engineered children search for their parents while trying to escape from their past, ultimately discovering they've been betrayed by the one person they trusted. Read by Evan Rachel Wood, the Golden Globe-nominated star of 13. Maximum Ride, The Angel Experiment is an action-packed, suspenseful, and unforgettable adventure.
Congratulations. The fact that you're listening to this means you've taken one giant step closer to surviving till your next birthday. Yes, you, sitting there listening to this CD. Do not press stop. I'm dead serious. Your life could depend on it. This is my story, the story of my family, but it could just as easily be your story too. We're all in this together. Trust me on that. I've never done anything like this, so I'm just gonna jump in and you try and keep up. Okay, I'm Max. I'm 14. I live with my family, who are five kids not related to me by blood, but still totally my family. We're kind of amazing. Not to sound too full of myself, but we're like nothing you've ever seen before. Basically, we're pretty cool, nice, smart, but not average in any way. The six of us, me, Fang, Iggy, Nudge, the Gas Man, and Angel, were made on purpose by the sickest, most horrible scientists you could possibly imagine. They created us as an experiment. An experiment where we ended up only 98% human. That other 2% has had a big impact, let me tell you. We grew up in a science lab / prison called the school, in cages, like lab rats. It's pretty amazing we can think or speak at all, but we can, and so much more. There was one other school experiment that made it past infancy. Part human, part wolf, all predator. They're called erasers. They're tough, smart, and hard to control. They look human, but when they want to, they are capable of morphing into wolf men, complete with fur, fangs, and claws. The school uses them as guards, police, and executioners. To them, we're six moving targets, prey smart enough to be a fun challenge. Basically, they want to rip our throats out and make sure the world never finds out about us. But I'm not lying down just yet. I'm telling you, right? This story could be about you or your children. If not today, then soon. So please, please take this seriously. I'm risking everything that matters by telling you. But you need to know. Keep listening. Don't let anyone stop you.
James Patterson, who's been thrilling adults for years, is now turning towards younger readers and listeners. Whether you've been solving crimes along with Alex Cross or the Women's Murder Club, or if you've fallen in love with Susanna Nicholas, you know the power of a Patterson novel. Coming this April, there will be a James Patterson mystery that you can share with the younger listeners in your life. So, get ready for a long car ride and a suspenseful story the whole family will enjoy. Maximum Ride, The Angel Experiment, is an action-packed, suspenseful, and unforgettable adventure.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.